The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today L. Annette Bender. Her new novel is The Vanishing Sky. She joins us on the telephone in New Hampshire. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Vic.
You were kind enough to send me your book. How did you know to send me the book?
You know, I had sort of been looking for shows that talk about books, and there aren't that many out there, and I was so excited to find you way out here in New Hampshire, and I wanted to share the book with you.
Did you Google me?
I did some really broad searches looking for NPR book shows.
Oh.
Because especially this year, it's so hard to get word out about a new book, especially a debut.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just doing searches far and wide.
Well, I will confess that I do occasionally get stuff from your publisher, Bloomsbury, and they did send me a galley of this book in the spring, and I remember setting it aside because it had a blurb from a writer who I admire, Miriam Taves.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, if Miriam likes this book, I need to put this aside and read it. And I fell behind. My pile got bigger and bigger, and thank heaven you sent me your book, and it perked me, and I said, oh, here we go. I need to read this book. So I did, and I loved it. How did you get the idea for this story?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your kind words. You know, my family is from Germany, and I came to the U.S. when I was a kid and pretty much switched to English immediately. And every time my parents would speak to me in German, I'd answer in English. And I never really thought much about my German background and my family during the war. And then as I got older and I was working full-time, I wanted to write. And much to my surprise, the characters that came to me were this family, this German family near the end of the war. And so I started writing, and I was maybe two chapters in when I started snooping around photo albums and found a photo of my father in a Hitler Youth uniform and wanted to find out more about my family. And part of what I found out about my own family found its way into the book.
You had already started writing the book before you discovered this fact about your dad?
I did. My dad passed away when I was 16 and never spoke about his life in Germany with me. I didn't think of it as strange at the time, but now that I look back on it, you know, not knowing a single anecdote about his childhood is probably a little weird. But yes, I had started writing, and it was really the mother in this family that I was writing about.
Mm.
And then when I found this photograph of my father and found out more about him from my mom, that's when the younger son in this family, it came into focus for me, and it sort of gelled.
And the family, they are the Hubers, and they live in what I'm guessing is a small city. In or a small town in Germany, and they have the two sons. And as we start the book, Etta, the mother, is very sad and upset because neither of her sons are at home anymore. And we're near the end of the war. Set this up for us.
That's right. It's the last 6 months of the war. It's become increasingly clear that defeat is imminent. And in this part of Germany, it's the southern part of Germany, very Catholic region, it's pretty clear that the Allies are going to be breaking through relatively soon. And Etta's older son, Max, has come home from the Eastern Front, suffering from a mental breakdown, and she knows she's going to have to conceal his condition from the authorities because otherwise they'll take him from her. And at the same time, her younger son, Georg, who is the character that was inspired by my father, is in a Hitler Youth camp, helping to fortify the West Wall, which is the sort of western fortification of Germany, which is something that the Hitler Youth were doing during the last, 8 or 10 months of the war. And he decides to make a run for it and find his way back home to his mother.
And her husband is a fascinating character. He is a World War I veteran. And we are torn between hating him and feeling pity for him.
Yes, Josef. And that character, I think, was in some ways the hardest to write, but also it felt very true to me. You know, he's not a likable character, but at some level, you can understand parts of what he does. Even though he's not admirable, he's understandable and he's human.
Well, I think the thing that makes a reader like me feel great sympathy for him is the fact that he's having some cognitive issues. And as you write in the book, you write, quote, "Forgetfulness ran in the Huber family in the way of freckles or knock knees or red hair." And you show us how he's in mental decline. He's a school teacher, and he's essentially lost his occupation because he's just not as sharp as he used to be.
Yes, I think that sort of frailty that comes with age sometimes does humanize him, and it makes you feel sympathy for someone that you might otherwise not have any understanding of.
Well, I really appreciated him because he tries to re-enlist. It's near the end of the war. Tell us how this was going at the end of the war. They were running out of soldiers. They needed boys. They needed old men. They needed anybody. And he's out in the garden exercising. He has this delusion that he can somehow be a fighter again.
That's right. He's exercising even though he sometimes forgets to put his socks on. he's failing at such a rate, but at the same time he wants to in some ways right the mistakes that he made in the First World War, and he wants to protect the country in particular from the Bolsheviks, because that was his greatest fear, and I think many Germans' greatest fear was that the Russians were going to come in and, do terrible things to Germany, because, of course, the Germans had done terrible things to Russia. And so he's desperately trying to get in shape because he wants to participate in the Volkssturm, which was the sort of final civilian effort to push back the offensive on both fronts. And in doing that, they were enlisting boys as young as 10. They were enlisting soldiers who were wounded, home wounded, and otherwise would never have been able to fight. They were bringing in the old men and giving them whatever weapons they could find and saying, go do what you can do. And so things were in dire straits, and you combine that with, at this point, a lack of food. People had ration coupons, but there was nothing to get with those coupons. And, some of these stories are stories that my mom shared with me of eating yeast near the end of the war. She was only 5 at the end of the war, but she remembers eating yeast just to fill her up her belly a little bit. And so, showing the deprivation. And at the same time, not trying to make these people heroic in a larger sense, because they were part of this murderous, evil regime. And so you don't want to sugarcoat things and sort of whitewash all the terrible things that had happened. And so it was a tricky thing to write about in some ways, because I think there's a tendency to look upon the Germans in the past of this era as being either heroes, the sort of individual people who resisted heroically at great cost to themselves, or they were the people at the rallies who were wholeheartedly supporting this horrible regime. And what's lost is the middle, the people in the middle who are struggling in different ways with living under this regime. And in a lot of ways, that's what's happening with the Huber family, is they're struggling, and different people inside the family are reacting in different ways.
The Hubers have a radio, and this is their connection to the outside world. And they also have a cinema that they can go to. And the father likes to spend his time in the cinema. And these sources of media provide a very distorted picture of what's going on in the waning days of the collapse of the Third Reich. And I love the deception that he engages in when he's not competent enough to be part of a work crew. He creates this illusion that he's going to work every day, and in reality, he just hides out. So he's still got it together in a way.
That's right. That's right. He's playing hooky and going to the movie house to watch, not the movies, but to watch the newsreels, which were coming out every week up until near the very end, until March or April. Just about when everything was lost, the newsreels were still showing sort of imminent victory. You know, things were going to turn things around. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to watch these newsreels. I spent many hours watching newsreels actually for the particular week in the book. You know, this week in December, this is what Yosef would have seen at the movie house. And so that was just, it was fascinating. And, you know, as with all historical research, it can suck you in because it's so interesting that you then sort of set aside the book and just research. And I had to pull myself away many times and say, okay, the characters are calling me back. You know, put away the books, stop watching the newsreels, and get back to it.
In case you're just joining us, you're listening to 91.3 WYSO, your home for independent news and handpicked music. It's the Book Nook. My guest is Annette Binder, and her new novel is The Vanishing Sky. She joins us on the telephone in New Hampshire. And your character, who's in the Hitler Youth, I want to set this up. A lot of our listeners probably don't know what the Hitler Youth was. You knew about it because you found out that your father had been a member, an unwilling member, I gather. What were they?
It was originally optional and became increasingly mandatory. It was a group for boys, and there was an equivalent group for girls called the Union of German Girls that in some ways started as a scouting organization and under the regime became increasingly politicized and a way to indoctrinate children. So there was a version for the younger boys, ages 10 to 14, and then once you were 14, you were full-on in the Hitler Youth. And the indoctrination was pretty complete. And in a lot of ways, they would keep the children away from their parents. They would separate the children ideologically from their parents, from the church, from anything else that might exert a countervailing influence on them in order to indoctrinate them completely into Nazism. And by the end of the war, these Hitler Youth boys were so thoroughly indoctrinated that they were fighting more fiercely than the trained soldiers in the army, in the other branches of the service, because they were completely indoctrinated and had been since a very young age. And my father, who was born in 1930, was of that generation who would have been, you know, completely indoctrinated. He was a member of the Hitler Youth. I found this photograph of him wearing his uniform, and once I started snooping around, asking my mom what she knew, what he had told her, what she said was that he had run away from his post and tried to make it back home because he resisted. He did not live up to his father's expectations. Whereas his older brother had served on the Eastern Front, been captured, and didn't come back until a few years after the war. He was in a Soviet prison and then, you know, eventually came back in very poor physical shape. It took a while for him to recover. And so knowing this about my family provided the kernel. And then, of course, there was a lot of additional research that had to be done about the Hitler Youth in particular, because my dad was not around to answer any questions that I had. And he died before I really was aware enough to even think of asking him.
These Huber boys, they really were inspired by your father and his brother in a way. And
the framework of the family was. In some ways, my father had more the personality of Max, and so my father inspired, you know, different characters in different ways. And my grandfather was a school teacher, a head school teacher in a small town. And the small town in the book is also inspired by the town that my family's from. in the Under Franconia region of Germany. So there's a kernel of it, but I think what's wonderful about writing fiction is that the characters take on their own lives and lead you through the book. At least in my experience, I wrote it without an outline. I just spent every day with these characters, and I was always surprised at what they did.
Mm.
And they really led me through the book. And even when there were moments I didn't want to write because it was painful for me, I felt bad about what was going to happen. You know, the characters basically forced me to do it, crazy as that sounds.
Yeah.
And then once I had a first draft, I actually sat down and outlined it and looked at what I had and figured out what I had. But before then, it was really just the writer's Ouija board.
Well, it's beautifully written, and I have to wonder, when you discover this photo of your dad dressed in his Hitler Youth uniform, what was your reaction, and what is his facial expression? Does he look proud? Does he look happy? What's he look like in the photo?
You know, that is, it's funny that you asked that, because in the album, there were all these pictures of him as a younger boy, 7 or 8, and he looked mischievous, and he had a sort of impish smile. And then the last picture in the photo album from his childhood is this Hitler Youth photograph where he looks anything but happy.
Mm.
He looks, the only other word I can describe, he looks very unhappy. He looks oppressed. And the expression in his eyes is an expression that I knew very well from him growing up, because my father, even when he was cracking a joke, the smile never reached his eyes. And I never really thought much of it. I just thought he's a serious sort of guy. But now that I see that picture, it sort of fell into place a little bit for me.
Mm. Etta Huber is really our main character, but the son who is with the Hitler Youth, Georg, he's the one, to me as a reader, that he just pulls my heartstrings. And he's initially proud to be in this organization, but he's becoming disenchanted, and the whole thing about him really falling in love, that's very powerful.
You know, he grew and grew as I wrote, and ultimately the novel was structured sort of back and forth between Etta and her younger son, Georg, you know, chapter by chapter, back and forth. And in some ways, the character of Georg, who would be the same age as my father, you know, born in 1930, grew up under Nazism, indoctrinated, and then left with a country that was destroyed, and having to sort of process everything that you believed to be true being revealed as a complete falsehood and as an act of evil. I think that moved me very greatly. And in some ways, you know, his attempt to run and then his attempt to make it back home and his survival is part of that whole generation, is emblematic of that whole generation coming to terms with what they'd been a part of.
If I had to pick a favorite section of the book, it's where he encounters the elderly woman. And I'm not going to give any more about that, but what a beautiful part of the book for me as a reader to appreciate.
Oh, thank you. I've always been very moved by older characters. And even when we'd go back to Germany to visit my grandparents, one of my grandmothers was in an old people's home in this small town, and my dad would drop me off there for, you know, the whole day. And I would sit at the table, and they would be sharing meals at long tables, at sort of communal tables, and I would just soak it up. And I was always I've always been very attracted to older people and the stories that they tell, because I think they're so often neglected.
You mentioned Café Klatsch, and that was my favorite moment in the story, where these women have gotten together at Etta's place, and she's gotten out the good china, and they've hoarded little treats, little bits of food, and little bits of alcohol. And near the end of their time together, one of the women starts playing the piano. And that paragraph, I had to cry.
Oh, thank you for that. You know, I love music, and I'm not a musical person. I take piano, much to the dismay of my piano teacher, I'm sure. I torture her because I lack musicality completely. but I am so moved by music, and my daughter plays violin, and she has an ear for it. And to me, the highlight of my week every week is being at her ensemble practice and just sitting there, and usually I'll be working on whatever writing piece I'm working on, and just soaking up the music, because I think it is so transporting. And I think in some ways that Café Clutch and listening to that music, a piece that the ladies didn't recognize, you know, it took them back to a time before the war, when their families were still together, when everything was still intact, before their country had been so terribly hijacked by this regime and people acquiesced to it. And I think that transporting power and of food and of music is something that people would really cling to at this time.
The son who returns from the Eastern Front mocks at the beginning of the story. He comes home, and this is unusual because it's near the end of the war and every able-bodied soldier is being sent back to fight. But there must be something really wrong with Mox to have been sent home. And as we observe his behavior, we find a lot of the villagers feel protective of him. They say, keep him at home. Don't let him go out. And the things that he says and the things that he apparently sees, how did you get inside his head?
You know, I did some research on what the experience on the Eastern Front was like. And then, as with all the characters, after doing the research, I sat with it for a few weeks before I wrote anything. And I just really put myself in a bubble with the character and tried to imagine what that was like. Tried to see the world through his eyes. Imagined this town in the 40s. Coming back from what he'd seen. And then once I'd done that for a few weeks, I was able to go to the keyboard and start writing it. But for me, it's always the character first and foremost, and putting myself in a bubble with that character, and then letting the writing go.
The book is The Vanishing Sky. It's the first novel by Annette Bender. She joins us on the program today. You've told us a little bit about yourself. Can you give us more about your bio? Who are you? What have you done before you wrote this novel?
Sure. Well, I came to the U.S. when I was 5 and a half and grew up in Colorado. Went to school and studied classics as an undergrad because I love Greek and Latin. Something I share with the character of Georg there. Also studied literature at Berkeley, Latin and modern Greek. And then went completely sideways and practiced law for about 10 years, found that I was not very, it was not a good fit for me temperamentally, even though I'm glad I did it because it was really interesting. And many of the characters that I met along the way practicing environmental law ended up in my short fiction, in my short stories. And while I was still practicing, these characters, the Huber family, just started infringing, encroaching on my work day. And so I started setting aside a little bit after work every day to write. And once I had about 100 pages, my husband said, you know what, just finish this book. Just finish it. And it took about 8 years to write. And once I finished it, I put it in a drawer. I thought, well, nothing's going to happen with this book. But I'm going to keep writing because I like it. And so I started writing short stories. And then once our daughter came along, short stories were perfect because they were perfectly suited for writing during that very precious nap time and, you know, those little spare moments during the day when I could actually sit down and focus for even just a few minutes at a time. And so I had a collection of short stories that came out in 2012, started another novel, and then decided to share this novel with my agent. And when she saw it, she said, put the other novel away and just revise this because this is the one that you need to finish. And so that's how it happened. It was a sort of roundabout path because it was not something I ever thought I would do. Apart from writing a few Agatha Christie-inspired stories in middle school, the first piece of fiction that I wrote was this novel.
How much revision did that take? Did you have the ending basically the same in the original?
The ending was basically the same. What what I learned about my process of writing is that I'm glacially slow. Huh. And so basically, I have to be happy with each sentence before I go on to the next one. And so on a prose level, revision doesn't really change the writing that much. But what always needs a lot of work for me is the structure. Am I missing things? Am I missing a beat here? Should I cut this part? Is it too long? Mm-hmm. And so the editing, the writing took about 8 years, then it sat in a drawer for 8 years, and then it took another 2 years of real solid revision, trying to tighten things, just tuning things in a little bit better.
Well, based on that timeline, in another 20 years or so, novel number two will be ready.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because I just finished the first draft of novel number two, uh-huh. Which is a very different novel, although it does have historical components as well. It's based on one of the short stories where a little boy who does not speak a word for the first 3 years of his life suddenly starts speaking, and it's only in ancient Greek.
Oh.
So it has a slight supernatural component, but it also has a lot of historical pieces.
Wow. That sounds very different.
It's very different. But again, the characters are the focus, so in some ways it's the same, because okay. The characters are really the key for me, and I was in a bubble with those characters, too.
Is Etta your favorite character?
I love Etta dearly, and she probably is my favorite character. Also, I love Georg a lot,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, because the book had sat in a drawer, and I had called it my drawer novel for years and years, and yet the characters were always on my mind. Even as I was writing other things, I just had them in my heart still. And so when I took out the novel and started working on it again, it was truly as if no time had passed. It was the strangest thing.
Huh. Well, Georg, he's got a bit of the magician about him, and mm-hmm. I'll leave that to readers to discover. But that's really kind of the thing that I see as sort of binding the whole story together, is his fascination with magic and the ultimate conclusion of that fascination at the end, without giving away any spoilers. I saw that as kind of the glue of the book.
I think that's right, and that's a really, a perceptive observation, because I think in some ways the idea of vanishing, the idea of being able to make yourself vanish, I mean, how many of us has not wanted an invisibility cloak at some point?
Mm.
But when you really need one is when you're in such a horrible regime and you would love to be able to vanish yourself and make yourself safe, because vanishing for him would be a form of safety. And so it is, I think, a thematic centerpiece of the story, for sure.
Well, it is a lovely book, and I appreciate it so much that you shared it with me, Annette.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Vic. It's really been a pleasure, and I really, really appreciate your perceptive questions. It's clear you've read it just incredibly closely, and that's really just a wonderful thing.
I couldn't put it down. The book is The Vanishing Sky, written by L. Annette Binder, who has been my guest on the program today. And when you get that second novel completed, I'd love to read it.
Oh, it will definitely come your way.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO for The Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.